Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
Well, here we are, and good morning. It's Wednesday, August 24th. Welcome to Wisconsin's Coffee Break. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Luke Mathers is here, and we are full today. We have a packed show of guests. Carolyn Fiddler will join us this hour to talk about Netroots Nation and some other national political notes. Then, in our last hour, our 10 a.m. hour, Kristen Lyerly will have her weekly visit with us. In the middle, during the 9 o'clock hour, we have not one, not two, not three, not four, but five guests in the hour. We'll be joined first by State Representative Jody Emerson of Eau Claire, who will help us to meet four women all running for the legislature across Western Wisconsin. So should be a very fun hour hearing why these women have chosen to run and what are the issues they're talking about and what are they hearing about as they knock on doors throughout Wisconsin. That hopefully will be filled with some good positive news, and we need it because, well, if you're going to lose as a baseball team, and if you're going to lose badly, I think it's best to do it while your fans are asleep. Luke has already confessed to being asleep and not watching as the Dodgers absolutely shellacked the Brewers 10-1. They got to Corbin Burnes early. He did not make it out of the fourth inning, giving up seven runs on six hits and only three strikeouts. There were some defensive miscues. The Brewers only got three hits in the first five innings of the game. How bad was it? Our eighth inning pitcher was the catcher, Victor Caratini. He gave up three more runs. How much worse did it get? The Dodgers then brought in an infielder to pitch, and he only needed seven pitches to retire the Brewers 1-2-3 on three flyouts. So the Brewers have now lost 13 of their last 21.
Ouch. That is rough. When I woke up to the score, 10-1, I was kind of like anticipating that it was late runs that fueled the 10-1 victory for the Dodgers. I saw that Burnes was on the mound. I was like, oh, well, Burnes probably took care of business, and then it got away from the relievers.
Nay, nay.
And apparently that's not the case at all.
Yeah, no. And in fact, it really is to the point where at the moment, we are not talking about the Central Division race. We're now 5.5 back of the Cardinals. Instead, we're talking about the wild card and how we're a game and a half behind the Padres for a wild card spot. That's what it's like right now.
Good thing we sent them Josh Hader, who seems to keep blowing leads and yes, keeping us competitive in that wild card race then.
That would be very weird if that's what this season ended up coming down to. Adrian Hauser will go tonight. You haven't heard his name lately because he hasn't pitched in 2 months. So we'll see if he has fully recovered from his injury. First pitch is not as late tonight in Los Angeles. It will be at 8 o'clock Central Time. So you have a chance of actually catching the game, seeing how Hauser does. The Brewers then have Thursday off and then have six games at home. Three more against the Cubs, and then three against the lowly Pirates, and for the love of all things baseball, could we please sweep these horrible teams? What the Cubs and the Pirates have done to the Brewers lately was unfathomable, you know, say in late June. And yet here we are. I mean, again, because I have to put drama into everything about the Brewers season, it seems, I'm going to plant my flag on, if we don't sweep those six games at home, no, I'll just say we have to sweep those six games at home. We just do.
What if we go 5-1 for that six game homestand? 5-1, you're still.
I'll still be okay. You know, of course, unless the Cardinals win six in a row.
True. That would be tough. That would take the air out of the balloon of a 5-1 winning streak. But yeah, I feel like they got to win the series, both of the series, and they got to get. They got to go 4-2 at home. If they could make it an interesting today, because if they win today's game, they, I believe, win the matchup against the Dodgers for the season, which would be helpful for ramifications later, I believe, in the playoffs. Like, that is a tiebreaker that would be helpful to the Brewers. So today's victory could be important, but I believe, yeah, they got to go at least 4-2 with this homestand coming up. If not, go for the 5-1 or the full sweep.
Yep. Question for you. Game of Thrones person while it was on?
Nope. I did not get into that one.
Really?
Nope. I didn't have HBO, and it was all throughout college, and when I was in college when it was on.
Oh, so that's right. This was a while back. You were probably, yeah, the TV ratings, you weren't allowed to hear things with naughty words. And,
no, it was. I didn't have an ability to pay for it. I was strapped for cash as a college kid. That's what it was.
And you didn't read the books?
I did not, but my roommate did both. Like, he had them all pirated to his laptop, and he read all the books and stuff. So I just never, he offered multiple times. I just never got into them. So
they're good. I don't read much for like science fiction or fantasy or anything like that. They were great books to the point where the author, I'm still waiting on that next book, buddy. Let's get this done.
I know that he's been sitting on it. So I do know that, even though I haven't watched any of the stuff.
This is all to say House of the Dragon premiered over the weekend. I haven't seen it yet, but I think I've decided I'm going to go ahead and give it a shot, and because there's just nothing new and fresh out there to take a look at. So let's sample that all together, shall we? Carolyn Fiddler up next after the break. You're up north. Welcome back. This is Up North News. You can get our daily newsletter by signing up at our website, upnorthnewswi.com. And you can send us an email by sending that note to radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And you can always listen to us live on the TuneIn app or tunein.com. Just look for WXCO and Bull Falls Radio, our flagship station in Wausau. Carolyn Fiddler joins us now from Courier Newsroom, a parent group to Up North News. She was at the Netroots Nation conference in Pittsburgh. We spoke when she was there at the very start of it, so we thought we would get a wrap up on activities right now. Carolyn, how are you?
I'm great. Finally starting to catch up on sleep. Thanks for having me. And nice to be doing this from my own place as opposed to a hotel room.
Yes, that always works a little better. Hotels can have rather sketchy Wi-Fi, as I've had to discover. When I used to come down to Madison regularly, I, you know, tried the, you know, the hotel, like I said, the hotel net, some are good, some are not. And then I compared it to the shared office space that I used, which was, I think it was like 300 megabytes per second. It was just amazing compared to like, at, you know, a lot of home internet is, you know, 100 and a lot of the hotels it's 12, you know, or some ridiculous number where you could carry the information faster and much less, you know, do any kind of a podcast or a radio show. So yeah, it's always good to be home afterwards, but had to feel, like you said, and I got this sense at the state Democratic convention in La Crosse a few weeks back, this ability to gather again in person, you've been immunized, you've been boosted, you've taken your precautions, and you finally
still
get
testing every day. So far, so good.
Good. See? Wow. I am big gold star on that sense of responsibility over there. Good for you. But you enjoyed, again, getting people together. And how did the tone at all change? You know, I asked, you know, in the beginning, if everybody was a bunch of gloomy gusses, the inevitability of a Republican midterm, blah, blah, blah. And you said no, that things were rather upbeat. Did they stay that way? Did they get better as people learned more? Did it get worse? What did you think of the tone?
It remained fairly upbeat. That's an excellent question. It definitely remained fairly upbeat, but also like with the overall conference had a sense of sort of gravity and responsibility. Like we're all upbeat, but we also know that this year electorally is going to be a slog, and we know we have a lot of work to do. It was nice to reconnect after those 2 years apart doing Netroots virtually. And there was just a lot of joy in seeing people, but yeah, we all know that like, things are bad. We have a lot of work to do. So there was definitely a sense of that at the conference too.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I can imagine. Now, again, in the whole note of having to temper expectations, you had results in several New York congressional districts yesterday, mm-hmm. and there've been special elections in other states and primaries. And there are, for Democrats and progressives, some pretty hopeful signs. And in one note, the four U.S. House special elections that have been held since the Dobbs decision in June, repealing Roe v. Wade, in all four of them, Democrats have outperformed how Biden or Trump did, depending on the district, in 2020. On the other hand, those are small turnout elections. So have I properly couched the optimism there, Carolyn?
You have. And that's a great way to characterize specials. They can present some tea leaves, but, you know, tea leaves don't vote. So it's nice to kind of have an indication of the prevailing winds, but also winds don't cast ballots. So it's nice to know that things aren't stacked up quite as steeply against Democrats as it felt like they were a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And it's awful, obviously, that the Dobbs decision is the catalyst of it, because, you know, people like me lost a lot of our rights that day.
Right.
And that sucked. But yeah, these are positive indicators, generally speaking. But there's still, you know, political eons between now and Election Day.
Yeah, a lot can happen, and can happen both ways. And I say that, again, trying to hold up any sense of optimism whatsoever for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which Ron Kind is retiring from after 26 years. And he narrowly held onto his seat 2 years ago from Republican Derek Van Orden, who then attended the insurrection on January 6th. And now, according to an internal poll that was released yesterday, is up by 13, 50 to 37 over State Senator Brad Paff. Now, that 13 point margin also comes along with 13% who are undecided and haven't picked somebody yet. But this is a Trump took this district with its new lines by 5 points last time. So it's still an uphill slog. Carolyn, is it impossible?
It's not impossible, but it's absolutely a long shot. The district did change. It got worse for Democrats. And as you mentioned, like, it was a tough hold a couple of years ago when the lines were slightly more friendly. So, you know, maybe this is one of the ones that Democrats can't count on in the fall. But again, long time, a lot of space between now and then. So I wouldn't write anything off at this point.
Well, and again, in part, it's the messaging. So here's what I'm getting at. Here are the breadcrumbs that I've left you. We have some races and districts since the Dobbs decision that have gone well, where Dems have, you know, overperformed. And there are certainly signs that that could continue if there is still, if the messaging about the threat to women's reproductive health rights and other threats beyond that is the message. Now, a lot of people would say in a rural district like Western Wisconsin, you don't want to talk about abortion. You don't want to talk about these hot button things because you're trying to appeal to a purple district. But there's it seems to me, a rising chorus of people that say, stop being wimpy on this and go for it. I know you're not there in the district, but, you know, what from your outside perspective, should PATH and progressives go harder on an abortion rights message, or is that apples to oranges comparing to districts in New York and elsewhere?
It's not apples and oranges. Yes, they're very different creatures, those districts, in very far flung places from each other. But I grew up in a really, really small town in the middle of nowhere, Virginia. And the conservatively, I mean, politically, it's a conservative district, but I think a lot of rural areas have something in common, and that is a love of privacy and the right to be left alone and to do what you want to do and to exercise your own rights and not hurt anyone else. I think that I know from witnessing, say, let's go back to 2010, an eon ago, when Democrats tried to run as Republican light in a terrible year for Democrats. And it did not work out. Democrats who ran as who and what they were, what they really were, very open about what they stood for, they did better. Did they still lose? In a lot of cases they did, but they didn't lose nearly as badly as folks who tried to, like, you know, scoot to the middle, mm-hmm. dance to the middle. Sorry, that's a very old SNL joke. lean hard into what folks believe in. That's voters know when politicians are being authentic or not. And there is nothing that voters have less patience for than an authentic politician.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the Wisconsin 3rd District races, one of course, many, many, many that will come this November. And we can't possibly touch on all of them, but there are a couple that, again, because you watch these things from a national perspective, I want to pick your brain about. And I'm going to start with Florida, where there's both a governor's race and a U.S. Senate race, and their primary was yesterday. And we now know that Ron DeSantis will be challenged by a former Democratic governor, Charlie Crist. And we know that Marco Rubio is going to be challenged by Val Demings, which in both cases, I think are formidable opponents, but Democrats have had almost no luck in statewide elections in Florida. It is truly Charlie Brown, trying to kick the football. So, Carolyn, is this the year Charlie Brown kicks the football in Florida? Oh,
that's an excellent question. I do think that the most formidable opponents came out of these primaries. I think both will give the Republicans in those races a real run for their money. But DeSantis especially has worked really hard to make voting harder for people who don't want to vote for him. And I think that in a closer election, that's going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Recent attempts to expand the franchise have been rolled back by Republicans in the state. Like, they're very dedicated down there to keeping folks who might vote Democratic from voting. It's not undoable, but it's absolutely going to be uphill in Florida.
And again, it is that you're always looking for those nice surprises, which we did see lately. And again, it's Wednesday now. So what does that make it? 76 days, I think, till the election.
Yeah.
Got a little bit of time. So let's get to the Netroots conference itself with Carolyn Fiddler, our guest from Courier Newsroom. As I was looking at some of the notes about some of the speakers, and I note this one from Alexa Moormeyer of the Cascadia Advocate, who wrote about a speaker, Mondale Robinson, who challenged voters to rethink what is possible and recognize the foundation that has been laid by grassroots organizations. The U.S., he said, has never had an electorate as diverse or young as we do now. Young voters asserted themselves in 2018 and 2020 with some big progressive gains. Mondale Robinson said, we must forget and unlearn all the BS we know about midterm elections and stop buying into the media's repeated emphasis about the destiny of a Republican race. That in and of itself is like buying into a conspiracy. Based on everything we just said, that still sounds rather wishful thinking. Again, not impossible, but it is always such a tough haul to get young voters mobilized, especially in a midterm. How would that be different this year? What would grassroots organizations, what can you do to actually make that difference this year in getting more young people to vote? Or is it going to happen organically just because of the Dobbs decision?
I think there will be a little bit of organic work, but I don't see his comments as wishful thinking. I see them more as a call to action. The prevailing narrative is, and always is in midterms, that young people don't vote, the electorate shrinks, yada, yada, yada. But it doesn't have to be that way. If folks actually get out and are on doors and motivate folks, tell people what the stakes are, motivate them to get out and vote, like, magic can happen. It's certainly not all said and done yet. A big difference between this year and 2020, especially, is the fact that people will be more comfortable being back on doors. 2020 mm-hmm. had a real sort of gap in terms of like actual field work on the progressive side because of the pandemic. That game is going to be drastically changed this year, and I think it'll pay off.
I agree. I think that young people being active, I was trying to frame this as if somebody comes to your door, it's one thing if they're the candidate, which is all fine and good. But it's another thing, I think, if young adults are coming to those doors and essentially, they're rather plaintive. They're saying, look, we really need this. We're the next generation. And sure, they'll get a few, old codgers slamming the door in their face. But I think young people's presence getting more active in this can indeed make a difference.
Agreed. 100%.
Well, this is what that we're going to talk about on the other side of the break here, is more about what are the messages that can work in a midterm election when people, again, they don't turn out as big because it's not a presidential year, even though the stakes are so high? And whether the things that we used to consider inside baseball are now fair game. I mean, we used to be told all the time, don't talk about, you know, redistricting. Nobody cares about that. That's a process matter, et cetera, et cetera. So when we come back, we're going to talk to Carolyn Fiddler more about what she's hearing, or what she heard rather, at Netroots Nation, and what kinds of things are going to work well mobilizing voters this fall. I'm Pat Kreitlow. We'll be back. Happy Wednesday. It's Pat Kreitlow. This is Up North News. Coming up in our next hour, four women running for legislative seats across western Wisconsin, along with incumbent Assembly Rep Jody Emerson from Eau Claire. Carolyn Fiddler from Courier Newsroom, political editorial director, joins me now. She was at Netroots Nation, a big progressive conference in Pittsburgh late last week. And we're going to talk about a few of the other states just to get a lay of the national landscape before we bring this all back and tie a bow on it with Wisconsin. But you did mention growing up in Virginia. Was the actual town called Middle of Nowhere? Or
no, the town was called Warsaw. It's in the northern
neck. Worse off, like you're worse off by living here?
No, Warsaw, like as in Poland.
Okay. You can see where I get that impression.
Yes.
My favorite Virginia story, my only Virginia story, but it's hilarious, is that somebody who was in Washington, D.C. at the time when the coronavirus vaccine was first available. And remember how like nobody could get it because there was such demand among the smart people who wanted to get it. And, you know, this friend desperately wanted that, but didn't also want to wait, like, say, in, you know, crowded places or whatnot, and had the good sense to go online and research what counties in central Virginia, where you could get to from DC, had the highest Trump turnout. She then called pharmacies in that area, and heard, yep, plenty of vaccine here, come on down. So by making just a quick drive, was able to get the vaccine by playing Virginia politics in their head. So yeah, that's, I would not have thought of that, which is what makes my friend smarter than me. But I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
That's how Luke. I did it here in Wisconsin, Pat.
No way.
Yeah, Madison. It was very, very difficult to get a vaccine right away in Madison, and therefore I took a little drive to Trump country here in Wisconsin, and boom, tons of vaccines available there. It was easy to get an appointment.
But didn't you have a tough time? I mean, I'm assuming you rode a horse and your horse couldn't get ivermectin because that was off the shelf. So
no, this was before ivermectin even really was all the rage on the right.
Before Ron Johnson was telling us to gargle more with mouthwash.
Exactly.
And everything else. Okay. let's take ourselves back to the Netroots Nation workshops and talk about all of these other states. There was one that I wanted to get to before the break. There it is, redistricting and gerrymandering and, you know, threats to democracy, frankly, January 6th, all of those things. Those of us who pay close attention to the news, I mean, this is all second nature to us. There are some of us who know that the number of documents that were found, you know, and taken from Trump is no longer 350. It's more like 700, but only a sliver of us know that. And we sometimes get caught up in this and think, well, if we talk about gerrymandering, if we talk about threats to democracy, that will be an effective message. Other people say, nope, A, that's too inside baseball. And B, they think you're overreacting, that there is no threat to democracy. Again, these are insiders at the conference, but what was their take on messages to voters about these kinds of things?
Well, their take was that, and I am inclined to agree, that making the stakes clear in terms of democracy being on the line isn't hyperbolic, and people understand that it's not. People have seen the threats. People have been watching the January 6th hearings. People know what's at stake, and making sure folks remember that isn't hyperbolic. It's not going to turn people off. It's going to make people aware and help people understand that their vote extremely matters in November. And redistricting was once seen as insider baseball, but I like to think we kind of started moving away from that in 2012 when Democrats got, you know, about 3 million more votes for the U.S. House and yet came away with a minority of seats. So it's gotten a little easier for folks to understand since then, and it's still a big part of the conversation. And voters aren't dumb. They're just, mm-hmm. they just have things going on. They have real lives and can only care about a finite number of things, but they're not dumb and they understand what's going on with redistricting and the fact that our very democracy is in peril.
It is, though, as I've given Bill Clinton credit for many a time, to first acknowledge that other person's pain, the angst, the anxieties that they have. It may not be on the same scale as, you know, losing democracy. But again, in that household, this is the thing right now, whether it's affording daycare, having any daycare availability at all, having health care, the lack of paid leave. You know, these things still make that first connection. Make that first connection with the voter based on, you know, what they talk about at their kitchen table. But maybe unlike in the past where you'd kind of skip the let's save democracy message, you actually then put that in as well, but you don't necessarily lead with it.
I think that's right, because folks have a lot going on. We all have a lot on our minds these days. And it's been almost 3 years of pandemic world now, and things are still scary and uncertain. We've just kind of gotten used to it. And there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And this, we actually discussed this on a panel, like it's possible for candidates to tap into that anxiety. Youngkin did it very successfully in Virginia last year when he tapped into parental anxiety around schools and education. It wasn't really CRT. It was just he made parents feel heard and listened to in a way that Terry McAuliffe, who lost the governor's race last year in Virginia, did not. So yes, acknowledging folks' pain and meeting them where they are is incredibly important, but then you might be surprised where they're willing to go.
That's interesting that you come back to Youngkin and CRT, because what you see in Wisconsin now is, I think, something where, again, this playbook has worked before, but maybe they're trying to go back to the well one too many times. In this case, we're talking about scaring people about crime. It's no accident that yesterday, on the second anniversary of a terrible night, a terrible day and night in Kenosha, rather than talking about police violence or the need for police reform, Tim Michaels and others talked about, you know, the fires and the riots and the violence rather than, you know, the root cause of all of that. And while most people have moved on, this is a borderline obsession for Michaels and others who, for them, that's the proxy for crime overall. Again, my question being, do they risk going back to the well one too many times and that people are more focused on their issues in the here and now? Or can that, you know, scary message still work in a statewide race in a place like Wisconsin?
I think they're going back to the well too many times. This was a year ago, and it's important to observe, you know, the anniversary of that terrible, terrible day and night and recognize what happened. But that was a long time ago, and folks have real immediate pressing concerns right now that involve, as you said, can I afford daycare? Can I afford gas? Can I afford groceries? And, you know, inflation is tapering off, gas prices are coming down, but these concerns are still very much in the forefront of folks' minds in a way that violence in Kenosha isn't. People react to what they experience every day.
It's just a reminder of what worked in 2018 for progressives. It was very much what worked for Tony Evers, fix the damn roads. Mm-hmm. Roads and bridges and things, you know, that touch on your hometown still connect with voters.
Exactly.
Rather than big, scary concepts. Tell me about a couple of the other workshops or panel discussions that you attended and were impressed by at Netroots Nation.
Well, I'm a little biased, but I did moderate a panel about media and misinformation and ways to hold the media accountable in either fighting the spread of or, you know, in terrible cases, promoting misinformation and how memes get from the far right wing into CNN and things like that. And it was a really good discussion. We had a lot of great perspectives. We had someone from Voto Latino to talk about misinformation in the Latinx community. We had someone from Media Matters to talk about sort of corporate media and platforms. We had Melissa Ryan, who's just a general right-wing disinfo expert. And we had someone from our own Courier newsroom to talk about ways that media can actually fight the spread of misinformation by putting out really good quality pro-democracy information.
There was, I don't know if this was Renata Robinson from the New Georgia Project. Was that the same panel? I'm looking just at a write-up about disinformation and saying that, you know, large amounts of disinformation focus on convincing voters that their vote doesn't matter. So it's not about convincing people to change their vote, but about convincing people not to vote at all, to stay at home. Right. And Robinson highlighted the importance of being sensitive when handling voters who fall victim to this lie, rather than making them feel stupid, because disinformation is doing what it is designed to do, convincing and upsetting unsuspecting victims, and no one wants to feel that they have been deceived or ashamed. So it gets to that notion of cutting through disinformation and really lifting that person up and reminding them, as I say over and over and over again in our Up North news coverage, your vote matters.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. No, that was actually a different panel, but fighting misinformation was a big theme of Netroots this year. There were several panels on it. And that's an incredibly important point. Making folks feel stupid doesn't help. It doesn't make them, doesn't sway them. It just makes them want to sit out or rail harder against, you know, whatever it is you're trying to convince them of. And that doesn't help anybody.
Well, for some of us who are have terrible poker faces, I'm hoping they then invent a drug that prevents eye rolling, because that I know that's happened one too many times. If somebody spouts something to me that they heard on some channel someplace, I'd like to think, well, I do think that most of the time I'm rather empathetic and addressing things, you know, in an informative and friendly way. But I do worry that before I got to that point, I've already given away the game by just giving them a look like, what are you listening to this for? And I guess we have to be more careful not to do that.
It's hard. But yes, I also have zero poker face and find that very relatable, but it's hard. And it was just important to, you know, kind of decenter yourself and remember, try to remember where people are coming from. People are scared, and fear can make people do and believe like really out there things.
Mm-hmm. All right. So apart from ones that you participated in, because you're such a big deal now, what else did you see?
Oh, gosh, I spent some time on Radio Row. It was nice to see folks back and on the air in person. There were some excellent keynotes. We had the leader of AFT and the leader of my former employer, Daily Coast, get up there and help with the final keynote speech and remind people what's at stake this fall. And motivate folks to get out there and work hard to elect Democrats this fall. And we found out the next year's convention is going to be in Chicago. That's exciting. so I'll be up in your neck of the woods next year. Yeah,
well, that would be great to see you. Would it be fair to say that, again, in the tempering expectations / motivating people column, is simply the notion that Ron Johnson, for all of the stuff he says and does and believes in and spreads, has still managed to win election twice. So you still can't count out all the cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs stuff that comes out of his mouth.
That's true. I mean, incumbency is a hell of a drug, as they say. And something about him appeals to enough Wisconsin voters. We'll see if that holds true again this fall, because I feel like the last few years he's really doubled down on his extremism. But, you know, there's a long time between now and November. But, you know, his opponent is a hell of a candidate. And I do think that I am cautiously optimistic.
Well, and that's the thing. Mandela Barnes is so smart about these things. He has the experience, he has the background to stay on message despite a lot of stuff that's going to be thrown at him. It's just that we look at Ron Johnson and we think, could this be any weirder? And then I look at Georgia and Herschel Walker, and I'm sorry, I do feel pity that he's in this position. Is still going to get a lot of votes, but is, you know, in this position and I guess could win.
Oh, yeah. It's still Georgia. And he's still a Republican who thinks that there aren't enough trees. It's hard to keep track of his latest hit. down there in Georgia, but he is not the strongest candidate the Republicans could have put forth for this seat. And hopefully that helps Democrats in the fall, because it'd be awfully nice to keep the Reverend Senator Warnock in the Senate.
Yes. Again, another brilliant and great person that you can have represent you. So between that note and J.D. Vance not doing well in Ohio, and Doug Mastriano and Dr. Oz, just whatever it is that they do and whatever it is they drink in the morning, there are these signs of hope. So Carolyn Fiddler, we appreciate the visit, and you know, thanks for keeping things tempered, but you know, on the good side of it. So great to see you.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day. We'll come back to wrap up this hour next. You're up north. I was mentioning before that I think I'm going to start watching House of the Dragon, simply because I did watch all of Game of Thrones. And at first I was leaning toward not. I thought, I love this series, and am I just going to be disappointed in any spinoffs or sequels? But you do have to be fair. Sometimes, you know, spinoffs and sequels actually, you know, perform quite well. So give something a chance. And as I also noted, there's nothing else on TV, and I can't just watch the Brewers, you know, falling apart. What's that look for?
We're in like the golden age of television right now. What are you talking about? There's nothing else on TV.
What's so golden? What are you watching?
There's so, okay. Have you watched Only Murders in the Building yet?
No, because I had to draw the line somewhere on streaming. I have, once you have the first 28, do you really need the 29th? And so, yes, everybody has raved about it, but Hulu is the one stream
the
that,
one that you refuse.
Have.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. No, there's a lot of good stuff on Hulu. Only Murders is what I'm watching right now. Marvel has got me, like, Disney could literally charge me anywhere from like $50 to $100 a month, and they're still going to have me pay for their streaming service for all of the Marvel content, because I love it. I love it. And so She-Hulk is a new series that just started. They had their first episode last week. I'm watching that right now as well. Have you watched The Marvelous Miss Maisel on Amazon Prime? Do you have that one?
I have. I actually did start that. I didn't keep up with it, but yes, I did like that when that first came. Again, that was years ago. So
there's four seasons of that now, and that's probably one of the best written shows I think there is on television right now. So highly encourage you to go back.
I really liked season one of it, and they kind of lost me midway through season two. It was just again, it was just too much talky talky and not enough laughy laffy.
It gets good again. So I would revisit that one, because that is excellent. I'm trying to think of some of the other. There are so many good shows out right now. I wasn't prepared for this segment, but
I'm hoping to jump into it and like it, because Game of Thrones in part got a bit of a reputation as not having a great series finale. It was good. It was definitely not great. Some people did not, and I'm not going to give you any spoilers here, but you know, the books aren't done yet. So you're talking about, this is no longer the vision of the author. This is just, you know, this is what the writers, who did a great job, but it fell a little short. So I thought, it got me thinking about the best and worst TV series finales. And for me, if you think of another example, a couple of examples of not so good ones, Friends was okay. Did you catch the end of Friends?
See, I watched Friends not in like real time. That was a stream, obviously, for me, because I remember my mom watching it, and I don't recall her reaction to the series being over, but I know that my mom was a very vivid Friends watcher. Sure. I didn't hate the series finale when I did watch it when I was in, because I think I
it was heart touching. Yes, yeah. It was. It just didn't have the same zip as when the show started. And I remember when it started, we were not sure. Remember, this is before it became a hit. And my wife and I are watching the first, you know, 5-6 episodes, and we're going, is this going to be big? I think we'll stick with it. And I'm glad we did. Obviously, it really took off after that. But, you know, again, the finale, you know, was hit or miss with some folks. The one that the greatest disappointment in a series finale lately, I know most people would say Lost, but I am one of those who is still passionately upset with the ending, the series finale of How I Met Your Mother.
That was the one going to be the one I mentioned too.
Terrible.
Terrible.
Just terrible, convoluted, and everything. They thought they were being surprising and cute, and it wasn't. It wasn't anything like that. On the flip side, I thought, okay, what are some good examples? And simply because Luke continues to be too young to remember these things, of all the lists on the internet, I decided to go with the one from AARP.org.
Cheers.
A real thing. They have a website or a webpage about the best TV series finale of all times, which clearly is not in Luke's demographic, but here we are on their top list. They put Lost on the list at number 15. And I didn't watch it. I know people who tried to and then got out of it. And so I don't know that belongs up there. Next, they went with The Sopranos finale, a show I never watched, but I know everybody loved it. And then that mysterious ending where it just cuts to black and what happens next. I liked that. Again, I didn't watch the show, but as a concept for a finale for a show like that, I liked it. I thought that was a great idea.
It was Don't Stop Believing, right? It was just
right.
Journey played out and it was a black screen. And that was it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Mad Men, they put on the list, but again, just based on what I hear, people really loved the show in the beginning. Did it kind of lose its way? And that's a theme.
I tapered off on that one. I watched the first couple seasons and then never finished Mad Men.
Yeah. How about The Wire? One that I don't know how many people watched it the first time around, but then later picked up on it and watched it and just rave about it. Again, not necessarily my cup of tea, but
Ryan's currently watching that one or rewatching it. I forget if it's his first time through. I have not seen The Wire though, but I've heard good things.
Okay. Saint Elsewhere was on the list. It wrapped up in the medical drama, which introduced the world to Denzel Washington. It says here, had quite the meta finale. It all ended with the note that the entire show had been the imagining of the autistic son of one of the characters. And that blew a lot of people away. The West Wing made this list. Again, that's another one. Remember, there'd been turnover in the cast and it was good. It was nice.
That final season is an excellent season of television, but the series did lose its way there for a few seasons because I will go and rewatch just the last season of The West Wing because it's good. But they did lose their way kind of in like season 6 and 7. It was
I'll tell you though, those first couple, like season 2, 3 were
just
so powerful. I can't comment on Breaking Bad, not having been, again, somebody that watches that. If you notice a theme with me, it's not much for dramas. I like to laugh. I don't want my entertainment doesn't depend on people being violent and dying. So I'm going to be a little oddball if you're big into TV drama, which is why Game of Thrones was so surprising for me, one that I actually liked.
Yeah, I like the medical dramas though too. ER was really good for I thought that was just they did it for forever.
And now that's great that you that one is not on the list here.
It's not.
They mentioned Cheers. I would not have put Cheers on the list, but ER when George Clooney comes up or when Juliana Margulies comes up and then there's George Clooney to greet her. I don't know if that was the finale or
no, that was the end of
on the way to the finale.
Yeah, that was in the final season. But it's Dr. Green's daughter is coming into medical school and is in the ER bay for like the last episode. And so that was interesting. Scrubs is a really good one, too. I like that. That's funny. Had a good conclusion, but
they have The Fugitive from 1967. That's a historic one. Mary Tyler Moore from 1977, historic. The MASH finale was phenomenal. I mean, what a gut punch, but it was so good. And then we don't have nearly enough time to give it justice. But if you're not familiar with the series finale of Newhart, the second coming of Bob Newhart's show, boy, are you in for a treat, but you'd have to invest into the whole thing. But it was far and away the best. Quite a packed hour next with candidates for legislature in Western Wisconsin next. You're up north.